As Andrew said, I've kind of talked about my home lab a little bit, and it's a little more extensive, I guess, than some people have heard. So I will give you a bit of a show and tell on that. So just a quick thing on me. I've been using Linux since 2001. I've been living in the region since 2004. I write a lot of articles on my blog at linuxtech.ca. So some of the stuff I'm talking about here, I've actually already made articles about. So check it out and connect with me on LinkedIn if you want. I'm pretty active on there. So this is the current state of the home lab. It's a 16U rack. I've got four servers. Three of those are compute units, and then one is mostly storage. And I've got a pretty hefty UPS and a battery extension on there, and then some 10 gigabit networking and a 48 port switch. So I'm going to go through some quick details on it. I'm not going to spend too much time, but so like the latest one I just picked up was a Dell PowerEdge R640. The CPU is a bit weak on this one. It's an 8-core, 16-thread. There's two of them, but they're only 2.1 gigahertz. So it's fine for some workloads, but it might be something I upgrade the CPUs later on. All the servers have 256 gigs of DDR4 memory at various speeds, mostly 2400 megahertz. They have SFP plus network cards at 10 gigabit, and then they've got a couple 1 gigabit RJ45. So this one has that mixed on an integrated card that goes right into the motherboard. Most of the other ones I've added on a SFP PCI Express card. And then I've got a bunch of storage that I'll talk about a little bit more. The other two servers are the older generation, the Dell PowerEdge R630, which are solid servers. I think they're from around 2016. The processors are older Xeons, but there's more cores, more threads. They run at a higher clock speed. And then again, I'll talk about storage a bit. So these two are pretty much identical. This one has a bit of a newer processor version, the E5 version 4 versus the version 3. That came into a It was important because I was using VMware ESX, and they actually depreciated support for the V3s. So the V4 was nice, but I've completely moved away from ESX. The largest server is this PowerEdge R730XD. It's got two 10-core processors. It's got 256 gigs of RAM, and it's got a bunch of extra storage in 3.5-inch drives and a couple 2.5-inch drives for the OS. So this is what the inside of the R630s looks like. I've had to do a bit of CPU surgery a couple of times. I was troubleshooting some memory issues when I first got them. So I had to swap the CPUs around just for testing. So that's what it looks like inside. I managed to get it all sorted out, thankfully. And this is the network cards that I'm using. They're either a QLogic Broadcom adapter or a Dell Broadcom adapter. The fanless one is, I think I've got that in my workstation right now. All the other servers mostly have the fan one, just in a PCI riser. Most of these are connected with 10 gigabit direct attached copper. This has a nice advantage over fiber because it's quite a bit cheaper. With most SFP connections, you need an adapter, and those can be pretty pricey. But with DAC cables, you get the interface on both sides, but it's attached to the line, so you have to you can buy them in various lengths, and most of the stuff is all in the same rack, so it's fairly fairly short runs. The other thing is it's less heat and better latency, so and they're cheaper, so there's a lot of pluses to this type of connector when you're running 10 gigabit. This is most of the hard drives that I'm using in the network storage are these 14 terabyte drives. I actually basically bought out an entire Best Buy when these came on sale, and they're just the USB hard drives that you can just like a 3.0 USB hard drive, but you can actually extract the drive. It's called drive shucking, and I have an article on that. Most of these just work like completely normally in my server. Some of these drives, just to note, if you're going to try this, check into if there's a 3.3 volt pin, you may need to tape it if you want it to work with conventional machines. Something to keep in mind. But basically, you're buying a USB hard drive, and it has an enterprise grade drive in it. Like these are helium filled, either Western Digital Red or Pros or Golds, essentially, if you look up the model number. For the 2.5-inch drives, this is mostly SSDs. So I picked up some OS drives. I've got a smaller 480 gig or enterprise SSDs for the OS, and I usually have these in a RAID 1 and with ZFS. And then I just recently set up a Ceph cluster for the compute unit storage. So I've got three of these 3.84 terabyte SAS drives in each of the machines, and I have one extra as a spare. And I wrote up some articles on that, and I'll talk about Ceph a little bit later. This is a part of a project that I'm working on still. I have the hardware, but I haven't actually implemented it yet. So there was an article on Level One Text talking about Optane, and Wendell's a big fan of Optane, and I jumped on the fire sale and managed to get a couple of these units, the 118 gig NVMe's, and this 900P, I got it on Facebook Marketplace at like $150, which was kind of insane. So this is really high level. It's good for like caching. It's I know some people are more expertise at Optane, so I'm probably explaining it badly, but basically the Level One queue depth is very good, and they are very hard to wear out. They'll take a lot of write endurance. So that's going to be for caching, but this isn't implemented yet. For networking, I've got a bunch of Unify gear. I've got pretty much all Unify gear, which all runs in a single pane of glass on a Unify controller. It's very easy to use. It does VLANs. The networking gear, like the switching gear, is actually quite good. I have issues with their routing technology, but for switching, it's actually pretty reasonable. And then I've got a couple of their access points. I recently upgraded to the Wi-Fi 6 access points, so I'm actually linking my upstairs to my downstairs floors using one of these wirelessly as a bridge. So that's what I'm talking to you on now. This is what the network looks like. It's it's not your ideal network. Everything's chained together, which I know is not ideal and not actually good practice. But that's just the necessity of how the house is laid out and where the wiring is and what I could do. So most of this is in a rack in the basement. And then I've got the U6 Pro upstairs, and then I've got two switches chained to those. And these little 8-port switches are really nice because they're 4-port power over Ethernet. So I've got some things actually powering, like the access point is powered over Ethernet. One of the phones is, I've got a couple security cameras powered off of those. So it's actually quite nice. And this is what the connections in the basement look like. So you can see the SFP plus. I've got 4 ports on the 48-port switch, and then I have the 8-port aggregation switch, and those are all 10 gigabit. And then on the right side there, you can see the 1 gigabit connections going into the switch from the house. So for the router for all of this, I'm using a pfSense Community Edition on an Intel NUC, and I'm using a little bit of VLAN trickery to get it to work because it only has one network jack. So I've actually set up a WAN VLAN where the internet comes in, and then that splits off so that I can have it go to the house. And I can talk about VLANs a bit later, but it's nice having a dedicated firewall, router firewall device rather than trying to virtualize it. These are all the VLANs that I'm running currently. So there's a VLAN for the network coming in, and then that goes into the one of those 8-port switches, and then I've got the LAN and the data are for regular usage. The guest network is basically over Wi-Fi only, so that's basically if I have guests over, they can use the guest Wi-Fi. They can get out to the internet, but they can't see anything on any of the other networks. It's restricted. The camera network is all the security cameras are on that, but the cameras themselves can't actually get out to the internet or anything. So there's no, there's been things in the news about Eufy and their cameras and their live feeds were being basically broadcast on the internet. These cameras can't even see the internet. So whether you trust them or not, they're restricted that way. And then I've got some voice over IP stuff on a separate network. And then the Proxmox and the Ceph networks are basically just for the servers to talk to each other. And then I have a DMZ network where I run some of the applications that actually do hit the internet. So I know someone's going to ask, this is how much power I use with running all of this. So you can see the amount of kilowatt hours I'm using on average. The price, you know, the usage goes up in the summer because we're running air conditioning. So I'd say about $150 to $190 a month in power. So it is what it is, but I figured someone would ask, so I'd just pull up the info on it. And these are the suppliers that I use. I've got FS.com has been really great for anything cabling wise. I get all my Ethernet cabling and SFP cabling from them. I got some of the patch panels from them. They're great to deal with. They ship, they're fast, they're cheap. Definitely recommend them. If you need a contact, reach out to me. Happy to do it. Prime Specs, a contractor group in Kitchener, I think. And that's where I got the rack from, and a bunch of the other stuff. They're great to deal with. And Deploy Depot is in, I think they're in Quebec. But they're who I get a lot of my Ubiquiti gear from. I like dealing with them over dealing with Ubiquiti directly, just because, they basically take care of the RMA. If you had to RMA something, I haven't had to. But they'll take care of it. And then you don't have to deal with the headache that is Ubiquiti support. And then a lot of the other stuff I get used. I get it on my Facebook Marketplace. I get it on Reddit. So there's a couple places I've bought some of my servers from, Delta Server Store, messy place in Toronto. Really good guys to deal with. I've bought a couple servers from them, never had a problem. They've stood by their products. So I would definitely recommend them. So I guess the question now is, what does he do with all this stuff? So I thought I'd talk about that a bit as well.
There's a few questions in the chat. Do you want them now or at the end?
Why don't we wait till the end? I've got a lot of slides, and then I we should have time for questions if that's okay. And I can't see the questions right now.
Yep, that's fine.
Is that okay? So the main thing is I'm running three of these compute units. The R630 and R640s. Are running Proxmox in a high availability cluster in high availability in a cluster. So you could fail over virtual machines between these servers. You can either set it up to do it automatically, or I can just move a virtual machine between servers seamlessly. The server basically doesn't even notice. It stays up the entire time. You don't have to shut down to move. I could have it set up so that if like I accidentally powered off one of these servers, the VMs would automatically spin up on another node. And that took a while to set up. And I have articles on all that. All three of these servers are sharing storage from those SSDs using Ceph, and that's built into Proxmox. So there's nine drives worth of data, but it's multiple redundancies because I favor the resiliency of the data over the performance. So I have a couple of the VMs running on Ceph, so their OS data gets replicated. You can see that there's backup jobs in the bottom left there. So I have all the VMs being automatically backed up daily to the network storage unit. I also back up some of the data itself on top of just snapshotting the VMs. This is what I'm running on these VMs mostly. So I run a bunch of different things for the house. I run Bitwarden. I run Shinobi for the surveillance cameras. I run some Minecraft servers for some friends. I'll talk about all of these. So the Bitwarden server, I just did this recently. I switched over from LastPass. I've seen all the articles on LastPass and a lot of the videos that have come out. And there's a lot of scary stuff with the breaches. So I rotated all my passwords. And I originally built LastPass to run on AWS, but after setting it up, I felt safer having it locally. So there's no accessibility to the internet for LastPass. So I use it in the house and I don't even notice the difference, and it's great. And if I need to use it from my phone, I can just open up my VPN and get in that way. And there's, you know, it's free, it's self-hosted, it's open source. There are some paid plans if you want extra features. I don't find that it's necessary. I'll probably pay for them anyway, just to support the development. Or if you really want to go that way, there's an alternative that someone's rewritten the entire server software in Rust, and that's called Vault Warden. So you've got a lot of options here, but I really like it. And it's, taking switching over from LastPass to Bitwarden was really good. I'm using Amcrest cameras for my video recording for surveillance in the house. So I've got cameras inside and outside the house. I like Amcrest because they have an open H.264 or H.265 RTSP stream. A lot of the cameras that you find, like the Google Nests and the Eufy's and Lorix and all that, you can't access the streams directly. You have to use their network video recorder software or an app, or it has to go to the cloud. Not these. These I can tap in right to the stream using, you know, VideoLAN or VLC. Or I can basically have this software, Shinobi is what I'm using. I've tried ZoneMinder and I didn't really like it. It's very hard on my CPUs. This is very lightweight and it does all the recordings. Like I said, all the cameras are in a separate VLAN. And then these record to a pool on the network server, the file storage server, which are running Western Digital Purple drives, which are for surveillance. And they're designed to be constantly written to. So that's why I've got two drives and a mirror to store the video surveillance footage. This is what Shinobi looks like. The live feeds are a bit squished here because they're 4K widescreen. So it squishes it to make it fit. But you can see you've got live feeds for all the cameras. You can go to individual ones. It does motion detection and auto recording. And you got a calendar for it. It's pretty cool. And this is the quality for like for a full live feed. This isn't even in 4K, right? So it's a pretty good quality camera. Like you can read license plates and whatnot if you need to. And it can all be motion triggered. So I run a couple of Minecraft servers. I've spun these up and down. I'm usually running a vanilla server on the latest version. If you're interested in Minecraft, linuxtech.ca/Minecraft. I did run some modded servers, but I found that these machines are not well designed for Minecraft because Minecraft needs high single core speeds, like clock speeds. And my servers have many cores, but lower clock speeds. And it seemed to struggle with a lot of the modded servers. So I'll probably stick to just vanilla. But I've had a lot of people on here at some points, and it's been a lot of fun to play with people. So if you're interested, definitely check it out. The other thing I did, and there's an article on my website about this, is I automated the entire install of Minecraft. Like you could take a brand new, you know, Linux server, whether it's, you could do it if it's on Debian or Ubuntu or Amazon Linux 2 or basically CentOS, and it'll basically do the entire install for you. So if you want to check that out, there's links to my GitHub and the work I did on that. The other thing I run in the house is free PBX. I have a voice over IP server in a VM that I started this because I was working at a company that specialized in voice over IP. But I tried free PBX on my own and really liked it. So I've got a trunk through VoIP.ms. So that's the digital phone number. I've got a couple phone numbers that if you call those, it routes to my server. And I have it's an IVR, an internal voice recorder. So like when you call, you know, you get the thank you for calling this company and plus one for this, press two for that. I have that for the house. I even have a little trick. So if it's a telemarketer, I send them to a special telemarketer hell. And if anyone's curious, I can tell you more about that. I do have a couple hardware phones. They're mostly Grandstreams. I have a Cisco, it's called an ATA, where it converts a regular cordless phone to a voice over IP phone. So I've got a couple handsets through the house that use that. But I mostly use Zoiper, which is, there's a version of the application for Android, for Linux, for Windows. There is a paid version. You can use the free version. I used to use Linphone, which is open source and free as well, but I didn't find the client very good. There's lots of options because SIP is such an open standard. There's tons of options here. This is what free PBX looks like, the latest version. So you can see the number of connections, user connections I've got there. That kind of goes up and down as things log in and out. You can see your network usage, lots of configuration options for who can access the system. There's no port forwarding, which is nice. The connection goes outbound to VoIP.ms and that's it. So I didn't have to do anything special from a networking perspective. The other thing I run is a Unify controller. So this is what manages all the network gear. You can run a hardware piece of network gear. So either like a Unify Cloud Key, or they build in the Unify controller into some of their routing software. But you can run it yourself on the OS or as a container. So I'm running it in Docker as a container. And it's been pretty good to upgrade and keep up to date, and upgrading firmware and all that for all the network devices in the house. Here's a couple screenshots of what the controller looks like, and you can manage every single piece of network gear from this one interface, which is really nice. So you can see at the bottom there, I've got all my switches and all my access points, and all the VLANs are all controlled from here, and you can get some metrics. So it's pretty nice. So I back up that configuration regularly, especially before I do an upgrade. And then, you know, I can upgrade the Docker container to the latest version. The other thing I run is Plex. I'm sure some of you know about Plex. So I've got, media so that I can share to my family members, some like family photos and things like that. There is a free open source alternative called Jellyfin. I haven't used it. I started with Plex a long time ago, and it's just because it's so ubiquitous that there's a client for every TV now, every phone, all that. I just find it's really good. And I bought the paid lifetime license. So it's not a big deal for me, but I have some friends that use Jellyfin and they swear by it. So it might be worth checking out. And then the last thing I really use the home lab for is dev environments. And this is kind of alluding to what I was talking about that I could do a talk on later on. Whenever I'm doing coding and I'm, you know, playing around with something, I'll just spin up a virtual machine, do all my work in there, and then trash it when I'm done. You can SSH into a VM using Visual Studio Code. I really like that. So like for example, I was doing a course on Postgres, and I spun up a VM, installed Postgres, and did all my work in there, and did all my coursework in there, and then I saved that to GitHub when I was done. So there's a lot of flexibility here, and it's also nice for practicing with things like Ansible. So if you're writing automation scripts, you can test that against endpoints by spinning up some machines. The last thing I think is what I'm running my network storage on, and that's TrueNAS Scale. So the original FreeNAS or TrueNAS Core is based on FreeBSD, and that has some limitations on some of the things it can do. Like I don't think it can handle Docker containers. It uses jails instead, or LXC. I think LXC is something else. But yeah, I know it uses jails for sort of like containers, whereas TrueNAS Scale actually supports Docker and Kubernetes. So it does its own applications through a lightweight version of Kubernetes called Rancher. And it has virtual machine support, so you can virtualize and have different OSs on there if you need it. It does offsite backups automatically. It runs ZFS as a file system, so it's got a lot of good functionality there, self-healing. I'm not even up to speed on all the things you can do with ZFS. It's very robust. And one of the nice things is the application support is that there's a group called TrueCharts. And TrueCharts, and I'll come to that in a second, but this is just what the display looks like for TrueNAS, because you can manage pretty much all of it through the graphical user interface. But TrueCharts has a lot of software. You can just deploy it instead of having to write a Helm chart, like a Kubernetes Helm chart. You just download it and you go into their little app marketplace, and you can select the apps you want and then just load them. So this is mostly what I use TrueNAS for. It's mostly virtual machine backup. I probably have like 6 terabytes of dumps of virtual machines and server data. I've got gigs and gigs of server data. I've got a lot of my old backups and, you know, personal pictures and videos, and the surveillance footage, like I said, is on those two Western Digital Purples. It's on my to-do list to get better offsite backup automation. Below here, I'm running my Pi-hole on TrueNAS. I try to keep the core services on the NAS, because that way, like, the compute units aren't dependent on anything else to start up. I used to have problems with that. I haven't set all these other things up yet. These are just some other applications that are available. So this is what the storage pools look like. So you can see I've got quite a bit of storage on here. There's a separate pool for storage and a separate pool for the cameras. And then it runs my Pi-hole as well on its own IP, and it's just a separate port. So I've got most of the machines in the house pointing to the Pi-hole for their DNS, and I actually have my own kind of internal DNS resolution for my applications. And these are just some of the projects I'm planning on doing in the future. I might not get to all of them for a while, but you know, setting up my own build server in Jenkins, setting up a Kubernetes cluster is a big one that I'd like to get to. It's one of the reasons I got as many compute nodes as I did, is because I want to be able to have Kubernetes running on multiple machines and being able to move, have high availability and move around Docker containers, move around workloads, things like that. Right now I'm running most of my Docker containers on just a VM, and I'd like to switch that to Portainer. Just the graphical interface seems a little nicer. And then there's just some other projects. I know like observability is a big one. I don't have a lot of observability and logging, nothing centralized. So I'd like to get to that. For my experience from setting all this up, these are just some of the things I would recommend if you're considering a home lab, is think about what you really need it for. Think about if you really need to run it at your house, or if you could do it in the cloud, it might be cheaper and there's less of a upfront investment. Think of, you know, your power and your cooling and the noise and the heat, because that's a lot of it. And also think about where your bottlenecks are. If your network is 1 gigabit, you might have some trouble. You know, consumer grade hardware. I've got a lot of enterprise grade hardware. Most of it's used. It's pretty economical. But sometimes you can get away with consumer grade hardware, and that's fine. And the big one I'd say is have a backup plan. RAID is not a backup. As an example, I wrote a couple articles on this, but I was having problems with my Minecraft server on one of these nodes because I'm using RAID for the OS, for the drives. But the actual RAID controller failed, and it was starting to write garbage to the backups. And then it corrupted all the VMs on that machine. So it's a really good thing that I had backups set up, or I would have lost all that data, even though I had RAID, even though I had redundant hard drives, it didn't matter. And if for resources, these are just some of the places that I use. So I would definitely check them out. Most of these are on YouTube. There's a couple subreddits I would recommend. Most of these have websites of their own. So definitely check them out if you're considering doing a home lab. The Home Lab Show has a great number of podcasts where they talk about different aspects of running Home Lab. It gets really advanced. So some of it's above my head, but I really like it. And I would definitely check out some of their videos. So that's about it. I figured I'd hopefully leave some time for questions and a demo if you guys wanted anything. So yeah, I see a lot of, I think, Paul, you said there's a lot of questions. So let's go through, I'll go through what's in the chat first.
Yeah, it's all in the chat.
Okay. Phone screen. I don't know what that's all about. Ron, how to present on KDE Connect, but it's phone to desktop. Oh, I see. You're talking about for you to present. Okay. Yes, it is loud. I'm used to it. It's like white noise. I wear headphones whenever I'm in the basement with my workstation. So I'm used to it. But they are screaming jets when they start up, but once they start to idle, they're fine, you know, and occasionally they will spin up, the fans will spin up, but it's really not that bad for me. For my next house, when I move, I definitely would love to have an isolated room with airflow and cooling and power for the lab, because, you hear it, you can hear it almost all the way upstairs. Just barely, but it's not too bad. SFP that has RJ45 instead of optics. Yes, there are SFP connectors that you can buy, SFP adapters for RJ45. You can use Cat6A for 10 gigabit. I didn't go with that because the adapters that I found, and I had one of them, but they were about $80 each just for the SFP adapter. And they get hot and they use a lot of power. And the conversion from the media conversion from SFP to RJ45 adds latency. So that's why I went with the direct attached copper, where it is copper, but there's no interface, there's no media change. So it's much quicker. And as for Jeff, yes, it is basically a router on a stick. It is a bit of a bottleneck because it's a 1 gigabit switch, and the NUC is a 1 gigabit in, and I have 1 gigabit internet, and I've done speed tests and I can get 1 gigabit download, but I'm sure that the weigh-in will bottleneck me at some point. So yeah, Mikolai, you asked if I use VLANs. Do I use tags that go to servers and hosts? Yes. Most of the VLANs are tagged. It's tough to answer that. You can tag the traffic. I'm sure the traffic on the switches is tagged. Most of the way I have this set up is I've got specific switches, like specific interfaces. So like these X number ports on this switch are for this VLAN, and then they just talk to each other. So I don't think the actual, I haven't had to set up tagging on the servers themselves necessarily in most cases. I hope that answers that question. I'm not using link aggregation. I had thought of it. I've run out of space with 10 gigabit lines. So I haven't done link aggregation. When I start hitting bottlenecks, I will probably have to put in some kind of upgraded backbone, but I'm not there yet. Some of the higher end Ubiquiti stuff can do 25 gigabit networking as a backbone, but I don't see the need for it. I think 10 is a good place right now. Yes, fs.com, deltaserverstore.com. They've been great. The pie hole is virtualized on the TrueNAS server. And let's see here, net data. I don't know what you mean by net data. Mikolai, I don't know if you want to talk about that. Dust control. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So net data is the tool to collect, different statistics on your servers very fast, very nicely, and then that can be used for Grafana as a source, and I'll put a link point into it.
Oh, thank you. Proxmox has some basic data in the dashboards, but I would like to set up some collection, data collection, to send to Grafana eventually, so I can have one page with all that. Dust control, I clean everything regularly. You know, I vacuum around the servers. I've used the compressed air cans. Whenever I shut a server down to do maintenance, I dust it out and then I clean out the back of it. How much time do I spend on steady state maintenance? I'm not sure what you mean by steady state. Updates and cleaning. Okay. I don't have that automated right now, I'll be honest. That's part of what I'll probably do some more work with Ansible to get the updates to automate themselves. Cleaning, I think I do that pretty well. Does running free PBX virtually give me latency and stuttering? Absolutely not. It's been flawless. It's running on Proxmox. People call my house, I don't have problems. I call out, no problems. I make phone calls on Zoiper on my Linux desktop all the time. Don't have any issues. So that's all the questions in chat. Is there anything you guys want to see? I don't know how much time we're at, how we're at time for time.
Another 5 minutes would be fine.
Sure. Okay, well, we'll probably do other questions. Oh, you want to know about telemarketer hell? Okay. So if you call my house phone, it says dial option. If you're a telemarketer or solicitor, press option one. That doesn't go to a person. It goes to a robot called Lenny. And Lenny will just talk your ear off. He's just a nice old man. It'll wait. It pauses between conversations and he just has some random things he'll start saying and he'll talk about. His kids, and he'll talk about his, does he need that, whatever. Yes, I record the calls. I have the calls. I've gotten telemarketers. I've gotten some accidental people who were very nice to talk to Lenny, unfortunately, where they didn't listen to the IVR and hit option one rather than listening. If I could do audio converting to text to ChatGPT, that might be smarter. But Lenny, the point of Lenny was to waste people's time. And you can find Lenny on YouTube. You'll find recordings of people talking to Lenny. It's not a new thing, but I implemented it on PrePBX, and it really wasn't that hard to do. No, it's not part of FreeBBX. I actually had to set up an extension. There's guides on how to set up Lenny, and you can find the code for Lenny, which has the audio clips that are used. Let me just check LennyTroll.com. I don't know. Yes, that is him. That's it. Absolutely it. So I have Lenny set up. I also have a special telemarketer hold jail. So it's extension 666, and I can transfer people to that, and it puts them in a constant loop of horrible hold music forever, until they hang up. So that's another fun thing that I set up on FreePBX. I haven't had to use it very much, but it is definitely there. I was trying to find a way to be able to, whenever you get those spam calls come into your phone, I wanted to find a way to transfer them to that hold area, that hold jail, but I haven't figured out how to do that yet. I see Paul is typing. But yeah, so I have a lot of other projects that I want to do, and observability and all that is something I want to get to. Yes, putting them in a forever jail would cost money, but sometimes it's just worth it. Monitoring and alerting role is something I want to get more into. The monitoring, like this is where I want to get Grafana, and I want to get some other software like for logging, alerting, things like that set up. I do have some things that will alert me. It will just email me. That's in the individual application though. So like FreePBX as an example will email me when there's certain problems. I think TrueNAS will do some email notifications as well, but I don't have anything constructively set up yet for that. It's in progress. The initial message on the IVR is just an automated, thank you for calling my house. You've reached this person. Press option one if you're a telemarketer solicitor. To reach me at home, press two. If you'd like to dial by extension, press three. The thing is that I rarely get anyone actually call on the house phone, because all the robocalling drop as soon as they get the automated message. So I haven't had to whitelist it or do anything like that. The reason that the telemarketers don't press two is because it's usually robocalls, and 90% of the robocalls get dropped. And if they do actually, get a robocall connect to my robot or my IVR, they've probably missed that part and they just hit one thinking that, oh, I'll just hit one. And then they get Lenny. Yeah, I'll definitely check out NetData, Nikolai. There's a lot of monitoring and logging kind of stuff I still have yet to set up. Hopefully you guys found that interesting. It's a lot of fun stuff. I do a lot of infrastructure things at work, and I find having the home lab available to kind of playground around in helpful, and do my own thing.